For those of you who were not in the lab lecture either this morning or this afternoon, we began the class today with a video. And to describe the video, what you saw is a person wiggling some kind of rope, some kind of tube, something that had some flexibility to it. And he was demonstrating what are called, he or she, was demonstrating what are called standing waves. Now, we're supposedly doing hybridization as a topic in lab this afternoon. And so you might think, how does a person wiggling a rope end up having anything to do with an electron? Well, I'm going to write this down later to explain it. But just to explain with the video we saw that if you reached a certain minimum frequency, you could get a wave generated. And then if you wiggled at exactly double the frequency, you get a wave that is generated that happens to be twice the frequency of the original one. And what you see is a point in the middle that's called a node. And that node is a value, a place where if it was being done perfectly, the function always has a value of zero. This is a special kind of wave called a standing wave. So a standing wave is one in which you have one or more fixed end points. So in this video, if you didn't see it, there's the end of a rope that's attached to something at the one end of the room, so it won't move. And at the other end of the room, it's the person that's wiggling the rope back and forth. So if it wasn't a person, if it was more like a musical instrument string, then you could imagine plucking the string, and then it would sit there vibrating back and forth. And so that's the type of thing that we saw. And then when we put more energy into it, we saw the wave could double, and there's this place in the middle where the wave appears to be still. So if you watch this video, it had some letters in there like N and such. N stood for node, where the wave was, again, if it was being done perfectly, would always be zero. So how does this have anything to do with electrons and atoms and such? Well, what's on your screen right now is an app called Atom in a Box. Atom in a Box. And what you're looking at literally is an S orbital. Now, again, there's some technological issues going on here, so you're going to have to turn your heads to see this better. But you can see on the top here, which would be your right if you're not looking sideways, that is the slightly scarier looking version of the Schrodinger equation. And that's what you solve in order to come up with atomic orbitals in the hydrogen atom. Now, two boxes down from that, you see this graph. And that is a cross-section of what this orbital looks like in terms of the wave function value. So right now, an S orbital is entirely symmetric, so it doesn't matter where around the nucleus you are that you slice. You go from the nucleus out, this is what the wave function value is going to look like. And notice it starts at the x-axis, then it rises, but it never comes back down to it. All right? So then, what if we went... Come back. There we go. What if we went to a 2s orbital? Well, notice what's happened. If you're looking at the color portion here, the picture, you see two different colors, and it's got a black ring in between the two. Those two different colors are the different signs, positive or negative, of the wave function. So you're used to seeing this in p orbitals. You might not be used to this in s orbitals, but your text actually does show exactly this in case you never got to it in class. And it's fair that your instructor might not ever got to it because this is a slightly more advanced topic, and there's a lot of detail there that's really more applicable to chem majors, to be honest. But looking at the slice, that's that third box down on the left, or third from the right if you're not looking upside down, twisted, you see that function now touches the axis. That's a node. We went up one bit in energy, and we added a node. Okay, so what if we go to a 3s orbital? Well, now we have a sphere inside of a sphere inside of a sphere, which means these nodes, which are spherical in shape, but, you know, chemistry wouldn't be fun if it's not confusing. So it's spherical in shape, but they're actually called radial nodes. Because if you look at that radial slice, it's a point on the radius where it's always equal to zero. We'll spin a radius around in 360 in all directions, and you turn it into a sphere. But you see, it hits the x-axis twice, which is why we got two nodes, which is why you got a sphere inside a sphere inside a sphere. And you just keep going up in, let me get that equation out of the way. You just keep going up in energy levels, and more nodes and more spheres. And this is all just s orbitals we're talking about. Sphereception. Yes, it's a sphere in a side. It's a dream inside of a dream inside of a dream inside of a dream inside of a dream. Yes. Okay, now you're used to this more. A p orbital. And section one, if you're listening in, I'm going to go just very slightly into more detail than I did this morning. Because if you look at this, you see that the radial slice is still the same everywhere. So why is the shape different? Because the node is coming from something else. The node is coming from the electron having the effect as if it's spinning around the nucleus. So this is what's called a spherical node, because it's related to, well, let's just get to it, the orbital momentum quantum number, the orbital angular momentum quantum number. So it's related to how that orbital is not really spinning around in space, because it's just a wave, it's just something wiggling, but it acts like it's going around and around the nucleus. So when you put one bit of energy into it to make a p orbital, you put one node into it. When you add another bit of energy to it to create a d orbital, well, now you can see that there are two nodes. One of those nodes is more clear. You can see the black gap there. The other one, it's a really complicated story. But the node is not as clearly visible, but it's there. And you can see that the colors are different, left to right, top to bottom. So those are two nodes because it's a d orbital. Now, not to confuse you, d orbitals can also have two-dimensional nodes. So this is that donut shape that you've seen if your instructor did talk about orbital shapes. And this donut is created by a hyperbola that is slicing through. So if you look between the purple and the green, that's where this hyperbolic two-dimensional node is. It's mathematically the same as having two individual nodes. So what's the point of that? Just to say that d orbitals, no matter what kind, always have two nodes, just like f orbitals always have three, and g orbitals always have four. Okay, that was very pretty, Dr. Gray. Could you actually make any logical sense of all that? I will try. The question is, what is the website or the app? Atom in a Box. I will throw it into the chat window. All right. So now let's turn this off. Thank you, iPad, for behaving through all that. Sometimes you talk nice to the technology, it behaves. Let me bring up a fresh set of class notes. Okay, and then my cheat sheet, so I match what I did this morning. And we're ready. Okay. Let me draw first into the notes what you observed in the first video. And this is what is known as a standing wave. And again, example for music. If you have a string and you pluck it on a musical instrument, it's going to vibrate back and forth, and it's essentially going to look something like this. Now, if you go to your participants window in Zoom, you have those buttons where you can say yes, no, or thumbs up and thumbs down and such. Just out of curiosity, just so I know how many people this will make sense to, how many of you do anything musical? Like play a musical instrument, sing, anything? A few of you? Okay. So if any of you have ever played enough of a string instrument, you might know that if you take that string and you very lightly put your finger exactly halfway in between the two ends, and then you pluck the string, if you do it right, you get a sound related to the original sound, but for those of you who know the term, it's an octave higher. Mathematically, what you did is you put your finger on a node, which means you created a different wave, a higher energy wave, which has a different sound to it. It is possible to do the same thing in other places on a string, to create other waves that match other nodes. And these are the same waves we saw in that video demonstration, and we can label them the same way we might atomic orbitals. So I'm going to call these waves n equals 1, n equals 2, and n equals 3. So here are two really important statements about these standing waves. One is that in standing waves, energy is quantized. Meaning, it can only have specific values. What do I mean by that? Well, in these, you can see it graphically, all the waves have to match up to those end points. So there's always some kind of boundary or endpoint or some kind of constraint on how the wave can behave when we create standing waves. And so here, this is a standing wave trapped between two points. So there is no such thing as n equals 2.5. You know, if the wave didn't match the endpoints, it simply wouldn't exist. So there are only specific waves, which means there's only specific energies. And an observation here is that the number of nodes total equals n minus 1. Now, you've probably seen that n minus 1 number before, like, let's say, atomic orbitals, which here are the first three types of atomic orbitals you probably have learned about. A 1s orbital, a 2p orbital, and then a, a 3d orbital. Now in the video or the app we saw that 1s's are simple like this, but higher energy s orbitals are actually more complicated looking. So you're used to this one, just like you're used to the 2p orbitals, and you're used to the 3d orbitals. Whenever we draw orbitals like this, we always draw some coloration in. Does anybody remember what that coloration stands for? Positive and negative of what? Of the wave function, not electron spin, no. And it's not charge, it is wave function. Because, and not the probability, because the probability technically is the square of the wave function. So in the p orbital, the two halves are equally likely. In the d orbital, the four quadrants are equally likely. So it is about the mathematical sign. You know, if we talk about waves, we could talk about light waves. And remember we talked about amplitude? So that turns out that amplitude is intensity, and that intensity squared is related to the effective power, you could say, of that light wave. And I'm saying this statement without checking it, but if I recall, well, I know in a sound wave, the amplitude has to do with the amount of displacement, and I think, again, the total energy content is related to the square of that. So in matter waves, like electrons acting like waves, the square of the amplitude is interpreted, known as the Born interpretation, not the Born identity. The Born interpretation, because there's more than one version of quantum mechanics. So in the Born interpretation, it's probability that is wave function squared. So what is the square root of probability? Right. That's why we don't really say anything about what the shading mean, except that the wave can be either positive or negative. Now, there's some values associated with these orbitals. You might remember an S orbital corresponds to L equals 1, or 0. A P orbital corresponds to L equals 1. A D orbital corresponds to L equals 2. Now, what is this L? It is orbital angular momentum. So those of you who haven't have physics, momentum is something related to objects moving. Angular momentum means it's related to objects spinning. Orbital angular momentum means it's an orbital that's acting like it's spinning around the nucleus. So to say it more simply, how fast an electron is moving around the nucleus. And notice something else here, which I said it wrong this morning. Holy smokes, morning section. Wow, your instructor is out of control. Okay, so here's the correct way of saying it. The number of spherical nodes, that's what's in these pictures here. And in fact, let me draw the nodes in to make it more obvious. The number of nodes is equal to L. Now, I said, I wrote by mistake L minus 1 this morning because I was thinking of total nodes. So anyways, what's the whole point of all of this? Because some of you might be thinking, like, oh, wait, does that mean, but what if, but what if, but what, but... So that was to rattle our cages and to scare you into thinking about quantum mechanics again, which, just to tell the story, I did take quantum mechanics as a course when I was an undergraduate. And what they didn't tell me is, well, I knew one of those things, because I figured out that it was a graduate level course that as an undergraduate I was trying to take. But I wasn't the only one, and I guess that was a normal thing for chem majors to do that were overachieving geeks. So then the other problem, though, is they didn't really explain that quantum mechanics has this whole mathematical underpinning, this whole system of math that isn't just applied to quantum mechanics. It's more general than that. But this is math you don't get to until you take all of calculus 1 ABC and then differential equations. You take 2A, 2B, and two more years of math, and then you're supposedly ready for quantum. Nobody told me about those 2 years in between. I had the prerequisites because I was a chemistry major. Oh boy, was the math something I'd never seen before. So the point of the story is that I was so thankful that in that class, I managed to get a C. And look where I ended up. No, I mean, really, I was super glad to get... So everything I'm saying in all this, this is C-level quantum mechanics. C's get degrees. Yeah, so imagine what A-level quantum mechanics are like. Because, you know, these wave functions I'm writing, just to go off the deep end for a moment, these wave functions actually form their own function space. So just like we have X, Y, and Z coordinates, these wave functions are actually their own coordinate systems in what's known as a Hilbert space, which is created by a countably infinite set of mutually orthonormal functions, which are continuous, doubly differential, and have a measurable space, which means they form a defined dot product that has a measure. That's C-level quantum mechanics right there. Anyways. Yeah, exactly. Whoa. Or I could throw in like a good Matrix style, whoa, right there. So the point of all of this is this. If you look at those shapes, notice how the nodes always go through exactly the center. Because there's one nucleus in an atom. So to start directing where all this conversation's going, I wanted to talk a little bit about what the atomic orbitals look like. And I wanted to come to this point. The unique shapes. Of atomic orbitals. Are due to the fact. That there is exactly. One nucleus. So I said that, well, I said a heck of a lot of things. I said that there are boundaries or conditions on the way that standing waves move. Let me take all of this on the page here and say it in a way that you'll be like, oh, he's finally getting to the point maybe. Electrons act like standing waves. Standing waves have certain limits on what they can look like. And once you take those limits into account, that means you have very specific ways that the shapes of standing waves can be chopped up. In a one-dimensional system like a string vibrating, you can either cut it in half or thirds or quarters or fifths. It has to be some whole number of parts that you break it up into. The same thing is effectively true for atomic orbitals, that you either don't slice it or you slice it in half or into quarters, roughly, or to the mathematical equivalent of quarters. In other words, you split it into a certain integer number of parts. So there are only certain unique shapes of atomic orbitals that can exist. And all those unique shapes come from the fact that atomic orbitals contain exactly one nucleus. See, that almost sounded like it made sense there, didn't it? So if you can remember that last statement, and go ahead and take your screenshots, then we're going to go ahead and move on. If we look at a molecule like methane, you probably have been programmed to be able to tell me what the angle is between any two bonds in this molecule. So what is the angle? Is the internet sleeping?
Yes.
109.5. Yes, because it is a three-dimensional object, so it's not limited to the two-dimensional page. So it's not 90, it's 109.5. And therefore, what shape do we call this?
Tetrahedral
is all you need to say.
Oh, okay.
And it's because all bonds, all bond angles, every aspect of this molecule is entirely symmetric, split up into four bits. Right? And not knowing how they're supposed to be labeled yet, suppose we wanted to talk about the electrons that are surrounding the carbon. Somehow they're going to end up in four equal energy orbitals, because that's the only way this molecule can exist, is everything is equal energy. But that doesn't match very well with carbon itself, does it? Because in carbon, If we look at the valence orbitals of carbon, we have the 2s and the 2p orbitals. And in polyelectronic systems, which means systems that have more than one electron in it, due to the effects of shielding and penetration, s orbitals and p orbitals are not the same energy as each other. So the electrons are going to occupy the orbitals like this instead. And of course, if we take the pictures of the p orbitals and an s orbital and throw them all together, an s orbital is spherical in shape. And the p orbitals occupy some of that same area. And even my own students from last quarter, you might not have ever learned this from me directly, but the p orbitals are given names, px, py, pz, because they are all orthogonal to each other, which given this is a 90-degree system, since this is a three-dimensional system, what does the angle be? Oh, how about 90 degrees? So, how is it that we have atomic orbitals that are different in energy and have 90-degree geometry that are somehow able to make a molecule that's got all equal energy bonds at 109.5 degrees? How does it work? And the answer is, it doesn't, obviously. And it's got a very simple reason why. Atomic orbitals, which I'm going to start calling AO, atomic orbitals. Fail to describe the structure of molecules. Because molecules contain multiple nuclei. So, remember what I said previously, the unique shapes of atomic orbitals are all due to the fact there's only one nucleus. Now we have multiple nuclei running around. That means that the orbital shapes are going to change. Now, if you get deep into the models, you'll find out that sometimes the atomic orbitals turn out to be pretty darn close. But in other circumstances, they're not good at all, like this. And I just mentioned all this technobabble about what wave functions are, this C-level quantum mechanics coming your way. So imagine that you spent all that time and all that work. I mean, it's a few hundred pages just to get up to the hydrogen atom in this course. That's how deep it goes into the math. So you spend all that time to try to understand it, and then it's like, ha-ha, these orbitals only work for atoms. So then what about molecules? Well, there's a way to cheat, and that's what we do. We are going to combine these orbitals somehow. But let me make the point here that what the problem is, in methane, for example, all bonds are equal in energy. And the bonds form tetrahedral geometry. ...109.5-degree angles. Even though the valence orbitals of carbon are unequal in energy, and different in geometry. So what's the solution? Well, like I said, we're going to create new orbitals. And how do we do that? We create a new set of hybrid orbitals. By combining atomic orbitals. Now, how we do that, I'm going to show you momentarily. But just to try to settle us down, because I know I started way out in outer space there, because I was just, trying to bring up a lot of topics that you may or may not have ever heard of before. And then I kind of narrowed it on this page. I said, here's the thing I really want to talk about, is here's this set of bonds, here's this geometry, but we got this set of orbitals that doesn't match. And so what I've now explained is, of course they're not going to match, because it's different kinds of systems. Carbon atom versus carbon in a molecule. So the solution is that we're going to create a new set of atomic orbitals. But the reason we did all this scary stuff on the previous page with nodes and shading and all that is we need the shading and we need the shapes of the orbitals in order to have the discussion for hybridization. So take your screenshots of this page and then we're going to take a brief pause. We're going to do an example now of how hybridization works. And the most important thing I can say about all of it is it's a model. It is not something that electrons know they are doing, just like they don't know what an S and a P orbital is. So it is our way of trying to explain how these things work. And quite frankly, that's because, not everybody can, and that's a separate issue, not everybody needs to know the hundreds and hundreds of pages that go into quantum mechanics explaining the electron's behavior around an atom. Some people just need to get on with life. So there has to be some kind of more simplified model that still gives you good predictions, still lets people operate in chemistry without everybody having to have a PhD in quantum mechanics. So that's what hybridization is. It's a model. And here's how the model works. Suppose that we had a molecule like beryllium, which hopefully it's intuitive that it's a 180-degree angle that the two bonds in beryllium are going to have because those are the only electrons in that molecule. Now, you can't just take a P orbital and stick a hydrogen on either end of it because each half of the P orbital is only half. So if you took... I could do this the long way, but the short version of the story is you can't do it. You can't just stick two things on either end of the P orbital. We need two separate orbitals to make two separate bonds. Okay, so here's what we do then. Let's take an S orbital, and we'll put right on top of it a P orbital. So a moment ago I was talking about sine. And so one of these sides represents where the wave function is positive, and the other one represents where it's negative, and it doesn't matter which one is which. Except that opposite signs, opposite colors, are going to cancel out. And so what you're going to end up with is something like this. Just like there's a node in the P orbital, there is going to be a node here as well. And that's one of our hybrid orbitals. Now suppose that we flipped everything around And just, I know the question's going to come up, so let me put it over here to the sign. Shading in these diagrams. Represents the sign, positive or negative, of the equation, the wave function. The equation that describes the behavior of that electron. If we happen to choose to orient these orbitals the opposite way and then add them together, we're going to get the same kind of orbital, but pointed in the opposite direction, the business end of it, the larger part of it. And the point is, if I take both of those orbitals and combine them, like overlap them in one diagram, then what will I get? I'll get the two orbitals pointing 180 degrees from each other. So hybridization creates orbitals with the right geometry, and if we wanted to discuss it, the right energy. Now, I didn't do the energy argument here, but I could, actually. It doesn't take that long to do. So before, in beryllium, we would have the 2s and the 2p orbitals, which are different energies from each other. And electrons would only exist in the s orbitals. But what if we combine the orbitals together now? So this is before hybridization on the left. And then we mix the orbitals together. Now we're going to have the two hybrids equal in energy, which Hund's rule, Pauli exclusion principle, all that, means now one electron is going to go in each orbital. Now these orbitals on the right, these are still 2p orbitals. What do we call the orbitals here? Sp. Because we took an s orbital and a p orbital, blended them together, and came up with this hybrid. And the process, the technical way of describing this process is what is known as linear combination. Of atomic orbitals. LCAO. MOUSE. Now, LCAO, linear combination of atomic orbitals. Atomic orbitals are added and subtracted to create a new set of hybrid orbitals. And darn it, I just had a mental image that I wanted to share, and it just fizzled. One second, see if I can get it back. It might come back to me, so I'll save a little space at the bottom there. Questions about this before we move on? Okay, well, let me come back then. Oh, see, is this because of constructive and deconstructive waves that part of it is bigger on one side and part of it's smaller? Yes, except that in reality, the waves don't actually add together. It's our model. That's the confusing part. But yes, if we were to take two orbitals and if we really were to interact them in this way, it would be constructive and deconstructive interference. Yes. Okay, somehow that mental picture that I had, I got lost, so if I get it back, I'll come back to this page. But now let's wrap the story up a little bit, because we started the meat of the story with methane. And in methane, we have four equivalent bonds. Which means we need to have four equivalent hybrids. Which means we need to use four atomic orbitals. And in methane, which let me go ahead and put the name over here. The atomic orbitals we have are the same ones listed before, the 2s and the 2p. So that is before hybridization. And after, what do we have? Exactly what we need. Four equal energy orbitals. And the really spooky thing is, and aha, I remembered what I wanted to show you. Back on this previous page, when I say linear combination of atomic orbitals, what I really mean is this. That you take each individual atomic orbital, you multiply it by a constant. Two purposes, and not everybody will follow this, I know, but I want to mention some math for the people who do get it. So one, it could be a normalization factor, because if you have one electron before hybridization in an orbital, you can't suddenly have two electrons. So you have to maintain your number of electrons, and that's why you might have one of these coefficients. The other reason might be not all the atomic orbitals equally add to produce the new hybrids. So when you carefully select your coefficients, alpha and beta, for a series of orbitals that form a matrix for which you can come up with a determinant, which is secular, which can then be solved for its energy, that's how you get those coefficients. And for the one and a half of you that this followed me right then, when did you ever think you were going to hear secular determinant in your Chem 1A class? Anyways, back over here. You pick the right kinds of equations. You mix the orbitals together. You get them all with equal energy, which means the electrons all spread out, which is exactly what we would want in methane. So, there you go. SP3 hybridization. Now, okay, you might say, why did we need four atomic orbitals? The short answer is, if you have the space for eight electrons, four orbitals, in atomic orbitals, if you have four atomic orbitals, that will create the space for eight electrons at the end. No, Dr. Gray, that's a hand-waving explanation. What's the real explanation? Okay, so in three-dimensional space, we can say x, y, z. Or we could say r theta phi. Or we could say r theta h. And none of those coordinates in any of those three systems can be converted into each other without rotation or some kind of transformation of the coordinate systems themselves. In other words, in three dimensions, it's always three dimensions. And those dimensions can't be related to each other. Orbitals are dimensions in their own space. If you start out with four dimensions, four atomic orbitals, once you mess with those equations, you're still going to have four dimensions, four hybrid orbitals. Okay. Now, how about some other examples? Because I wrote methane up here, but what if we had what is known as the methyl anion? Anion, of course, means negative charge. Methyl means related to methane. I'm going to ask a question. What would you guess the bond angle would be in between any two bonds in this molecule? Now, everyone that realizes you have the internet that you can go ask, when I tried... What's that?
Less than 109.5.
Yeah, and actually that's the answer that I came up with. I was like, okay, let me go find that exact answer. And it turned out I couldn't find it right away. But yeah, it's probably less than 109.5. I want to draw another molecule up just for comparison. And so I'll come back here and say less than 109.5. But we might make some estimates, because what's the bond angle here in ammonia?
The same.
Does anybody happen to know what the bond angle is? Because this one, you can find the number. Well, it's 107. And let's compare water with that. You know, what if you have two lone pairs? What does that do in water? Yeah, it shrinks it. Why does the bond angle decrease? Ah, sorry. Where'd you go? Oh, wrong class. Yeah. There we go. And the chat window says nothing. I'll ask it again. Why are the bond angles smaller in these example molecules than 109.5?
Because there's more repulsion forces, because there's more electronegativity.
Ooh, I wouldn't say electronegativity.
What's it called? There's more repulsive forces because there's more electrons in that area.
The lone pair has more repulsive force because there's no nucleus on the other side of it, yes. So the lone pair or pairs squish the bonds together. But notice even in water with two lone pairs, it's only about 5 degrees difference. So all of these shapes are almost identical to tetrahedral geometry. And that's why they all belong to the same electron pair geometry. Back in 1A, you might have learned about this difference in terms. True molecular geometry takes into account the differences between bonds and lone pairs. So methane is tetrahedral. The methyl anion and ammonia are both trigonal pyramidal, water is bent. But in terms of hybridization is a model that tries to come up with orbitals that match a true molecule. And all these molecules are about the same as each other, which means they're all sp3 hybridized systems. Since they all have the same electron pair geometry, therefore, they are all best described by sp3 hybrids. And so this is where we come to the point. Because if you take Chem 1C, you might need to answer this question. If you take Chem 12A, oh my gosh, you're doing this all the time. What is the hybridization of this atom? What is the hybridization of that atom? And the answer is this, that the number of hybrid orbitals which tells you your hybridization type. SP is two orbitals. SP2 is three. SP3 is four. SP3D is five. The number of orbital hybrids, which tells you which type, is equal to the number of bonds and lone pairs. Which is exactly the same thing that determines Vesper shape. But I want to make a comment about this bond part. That when you count the number of bonds, single, double, and triple bonds are all counted once. Why? Okay, that's where we get to the last part of the story here for today. So please go ahead and take your screenshots. So, let me show you an example molecule and explain what this last statement was. The number of hybrids depend on the number of bonds and lone pairs. So this is the molecule ethene. At least that's its systematic name. Its common name is ethylene. If you look at each of the carbons, we're going to treat both of them separately. And that's what we do with Vesper theory. That's what we do with hybridization. And so what would we predict the hybridization would be in this case? It would be sp2. Why? Because we have a total of three individual bonds. Doesn't matter that one of them is double. They're three bonds. Okay, so what would an sp2 hybridized system look like? Before I can get there, I've got to make one aside, one simplification. So an sp2 orbital really looks like this. One larger end than the other. And what we're going to do is we're going to leave out the tail, you could say, the smaller end, or what's technically called the minor lobe. And the reason I'm going to do this is it makes the diagrams a lot easier to read. Because here's what it looks like. If you say sp2, you have one set of three sp2 hybridized orbitals. Because we needed three orbitals in the first place because there's three types of bonds. Now each carbon has that. And notice, we don't connect the blobs together, like where the two carbons meet. We show them still as individual hybrids. And now we're going to have hydrogen here as well. And the hydrogens, we're going to call S orbitals. And we'll get more to that later when we have time. If we look at the orbitals for carbon again, 2s and 2p. We hybridize, and what do we get? SP2, but still there's a P orbital left over. So this is before and after hybridization. Now leave the energies out for a minute, because it kind of confused things this morning. So point's this. On each of these, we still have a P orbital that's available then. So there's two types of interactions that can happen between atoms here. And one of these, you can tell, is where the atoms, the orbitals, they touch head to head. And so that is what is known as a sigma bond. But these P orbitals, they're close enough together that they will also overlap. And it produces what's known as a pi bond. We will talk more about sigma and pi bonds next time, because next time we're supposed to talk about bonding. And one very important note, that shading in this diagram represents orbital type, not sign.
Professor?
Yeah.
Just out of where did those red blobs come from? I know they represent pi bonds, but
that's the P orbital that's left over after hybridization. What I just circled there. So in the middle of the page, kind of, you see where I had before and after. So after, there's still a P orbital, which is what's in the middle of each of those clusters of sp2 hybrids. Now, carbon has four valence electrons, right? So one valence electron can combine with hydrogen. Another valence electron can combine with hydrogen. Another valence electron could combine with the other carbon. Those would be your three sigma bonds. Now, once they combine with other electrons from the other atoms, those resulting bonds will be full. There's still one more valence electron on carbon left, which, even though it looks like it violates the rules, in this case it doesn't, because science. Because there's a long explanation that I can't do in 2 minutes to justify that fully. But it is true. There will effectively be a P orbital in that, there will effectively be an electron in that P orbital. And if the P orbitals overlap, and that means two electrons interact, that's your second bond. That's actually what a double bond is. A combination of a sigma bond, a head-to-head overlap, and then a side-to-side overlap from the P orbitals. Now, what was the whole point of this? Well, for those of you going into organic chemistry, we do this like without thinking by the point you get in about halfway of 12A. Or you have to get to the point where you can do this without thinking by the halfway point of 12A. Otherwise, you don't make it through the class. Because we talk about why organic molecules do what they do, and it's all based on shape and bond type. So you have to be able to do this. The other way, the reason I wanted to do this is just for the justification of why do single and double and triple bonds all count the same? Because the double bonds don't come from interactions that are head-to-head interactions. So, hand-waving explanation, they don't really have much effect on geometry. Not from the way that you have learned about structure. And triple bond would have the same thing. And if we get the time, we're going to see what a triple bond looks like so I can tell that story. But at least we got up through what I wanted to get through today, which is what is hybridization? It's a model for coming up with new orbitals that give us the right geometry and energy for systems that have multiple electrons. And we've talked about how to create orbitals. And then we've also now talked about how to predict what kind of orbitals will be present.